I think that a sort of marketing decision has been made by many churches to present Christianity in forms that they assume are more palatable. And I think that's a terrible condescension to people in general. I mean, I think that religion at its best is not pandering. It's actually one place in the world where you might reasonably expect someone to tell you the truth, even if it does run against what your preferences are.
On this edition of The White Horse Inn, I'll be talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Marilyn Robinson. The White Horse Inn. Know what you believe and why you believe it.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition of the early reformers, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Born and raised in Sandpoint, Idaho, Professor Robinson received her undergraduate degree at Brown and her PhD at the University of Washington. Her first book, Housekeeping, published in 1980, was voted one of the 100 greatest novels of all time by The Observer and one of the books of the century by the New York Times. It was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Her second novel, Gilead, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2005, and the third novel, Home, was a finalist for the 2008 National Book Award and won the 2009 Orange Prize for Fiction. Professor Robinson's also the author of Mother Country, Britain, the Welfare State, and Nuclear Pollution, and The Death of Adam, Essays on Modern Thought. The Times of London named her the world's best writer of prose. One reviewer sums up the appraisal of many. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that you're actually dead if you haven't read Marilyn Robinson, but I honestly couldn't say that you're fully alive. Professor Robinson, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Professor Robinson, a recurring theme in your novels seems to be home. Is rootlessness, distraction, even a lonely kind of vagrancy a part of the modern condition?
I think it's part of the human condition. One of the things that I think marks particularly Old Testament literature, but the New Testament has elements of it also, is the idea of the human being as a sojourner, a human society as being something that can't be assumed, that is temporary.
Now, a lot of people would like for me to, especially your fans listening to us, would like for me to spend most of the time, I'm sure, on the novels, but I just have to go to the work you wrote in 1998, The Death of Adam, a Collection of Essays. Where did you come up with the title, and what led you to write these essays?
The title actually comes from the cover painting of Piero della Francesca. The painting assumes that Adam is the first person to die a natural death. And so there's this sort of astonished group of people, you know, pondering his demise, his death. Adam, for me, has connotations of the idea of the human being as the image of God. And I think that idea is always fragile and certainly is not compatible with the way that a lot of modern thinking has gone on.
That leads in well to your first chapter, in fact, on Darwinism. You write, the modern fable is that science exposed religion as a delusion and more or less supplanted it, but science cannot serve in the place of religion because it can't generate an ethics or a morality. It can give us no reason to prefer a child to a dog or to choose honorable poverty over fraudulent wealth. It can give us no grounds for preferring what is excellent to what is sensationalistic. And this is more or less where we are now. Can you summarize briefly for us? I know there's so much packed into that one essay. Can you unpack it a little bit for us, the Darwinism essay in The Death of Adam?
It has been very true. I think that Darwin's thesis has been overinterpreted in a way that makes it seem as if it's the sort of explanation for absolutely everything. You find writers like Daniel Dennett and so on who really want to apply this model to everything. And one of the consequences of this is that it arrives at a reductive statement about human beings, what they are, what their motives are, what the range of their meaningful behavior is, you know, if it's understood in its essence and so on. there, it was as if the world was waiting to unburden itself of the obligations that are implied by the idea of the holiness of the human being, and embraced that theory and elaborated it in many directions that are not scientific and that, are not fruitful.
So reducing human existence either to material processes or to economic processes and forces as if we're just sort of a plaything of fate?
There's that. Many things have, there have been many variants on this sort of idea, that say human beings are merely X, their motives are simply Y and Z, all kinds of theories have come along that seem as if their end point is to be able to make statements that are reductionist in that sense. If you read actual scientific descriptions of the brain, it's something that is so complex that it obviously should make anyone hesitant to make reductionist statements about what a human being is, what its motives and capacities are available to us. But there's this other tendency, which I call parascience, to make an argument that looks scientific but has nothing to do with the way that something is actually thought of scientifically.
And you think that people like Daniel Dennett and the New Atheists are sort of exhibiting that tendency?
Oh, certainly they do. The reductionist impulse, the word reductionist has two senses, of course, and one of them is to sort of simplify a question insofar as possible in order to make it more approachable. But the other is to arrive at conclusions that simplify phenomena beyond the point where simplification is appropriate, and I'm using it in that second sense. The idea that basically people have two motives and that everything can be understood in those terms is just bizarrely reductionist. And the idea that we can draw conclusions about what the universe is on the basis of very narrow samples of reality that they offer to us, this is clearly reductionist in a very odd sense, almost a form of primitivity.
A novelist would probably see the reductionism more quickly than a lot of people, being very aware of the complexity of characters and lives and motives.
You do spend a lot of time thinking about that, or perhaps you couldn't be a novelist if you didn't.
One of the things that really, I thought that I had read Darwin's Origin of the Species, but evidently not the parts that really bowled me over. I had no idea that already in Darwin himself there was such a connection between the survival of the fittest, natural selection, and the sociology associated with Herbert Spencer and others, namely of lesser civilizations and peoples perishing and being supplanted by stronger and more intelligent species, that kind of dark aspect of Darwinism. You paint that pretty starkly. In fact, you say Darwinism is harsh and crude in its practical consequences in a degree that sets it apart from all other respectable scientific hypotheses. Not coincidentally, it had its origins in polemics against the poor and against the irksome burden of extending charity to them, a burden laid on the back of Europe by Christianity. Can you explain that?
When you look at the origins of Darwin's own thesis, which he's candid about, he talks about getting the basic formula from the theory of population of Parson Malthus, that there is simply a limit to how much population can be sustained in a certain ecology, and that inevitably people will die off from starvation. And of course, the theory that the stronger will flourish when there is competition and that the weaker will fall away and perish, this was a very convenient idea for Europe at a time when a great many people in any population really did starve to death. It was not an unusual fate. When you take that as being a natural process rather than being something that derives very directly from the way in which wealth is dispersed through an economy, then necessarily you make it seem inevitable and even good. And that was one of the consequences of social Darwinist thought, that you had to be cruel to be kind. You had to let the weak perish, or the poor, or the primitive in the terms that Europe brought into that moment, that view of the world.
Until you get to Peter Singer, the ethicist at Princeton, who says much the same thing.
There are always those people. It's a very vigorous tradition, this idea that the poor are a burden and that the people who basically manage to flourish in the most economic terms, in the most physical terms, those are the people who ought to thrive and will produce healthy offspring and all the rest of it. It's just almost a second religion in Western thought.
You told Publishers Weekly concerning this book, "My intention, my hope, is to revive interest in John Calvin. If I'd been forthright about my subject, I doubt the average reader would have read this far." Why your interest, that everybody comments on, your interest in Calvin and Calvinism?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I was reading Moby Dick. I was teaching Moby Dick in a seminar, and that book is just very dense with theological references. So it occurred to me that I should read the theology that he would be in conversation with, you know, and which is, of course, Calvin. So I went to the library and got the Institutes and read them, it's amazing for an educated person in the Western world, where Calvin is considered to be one of the formative figures in Western civilization, that I'd never thought of reading him until then. I, whose family was Presbyterian. In any case, I did read him, and I thought, you know, this is very major theology. And the more Calvin I read, the more impressed I was and have continued to be by the real profundity of his thought and the degree to which it is a sort of another vision, another major vision of what Christianity means. So once I simply made the acquaintance of this body of work, I necessarily was fascinated by it.
What moves you most about Calvin's thought?
Well, I think what moves me most about it is that he has such an incredibly high sense of what human beings are. It's the most profoundly humanist articulation of Christianity that I've ever encountered.
How do you get a high view of human beings and the idea that he's probably more noted for in the West, such a stark and stunning view of human depravity?
Well, I think that that's a false interpretation of his thought. Depravity in Latin and in his French meant warping. It was sort of like you would say that a mirror was dépravé, or you would say that a text, if there's a flaw in a text, you would say it was dépravé. What it means really is that original sin affects us in every way. I mean, it affects how we see the world, how we understand, and the rest of it. It's sort of like the contest that human beings are inevitably engrossed by, because they are fallible always, but not always knowing in what way fallible, you know.
So the sort of dominant high school view that a lot of people get of Calvin as black and white, almost a Manichaean division of reality into obvious light and darkness, doesn't really resonate with his more complex view of reality as good stuff twisted by sin.
Really, I mean, it's true that the folklore that surrounds him is dense and bizarre, and one of the things that makes it really difficult to draw people's attention to what he actually did say. I think that there was a very, very violent polemic against him because he was the most important leader of the Reformation in the Reformation's most inflamed period. And people basically saying anything about him they could in order to diminish his stature and influence. And a lot of that polemic has just never gone away. In fact, it became what people perceive as being true about him.
On this edition of The White Horse Inn, I'm talking to Marilyn Robinson, author of Gilead and Home. We'll be back after this break. Hey, folks, Michael Horton here. Have you considered supporting our efforts here at The White Horse Inn? For your tax purposes and ours, December 31st, of course, is the big day. So as our way of saying thank you for a gift of $100 or more by December 31st, we'll send you our Celebrating 20 Years MP3 CD featuring 20 of our best programs ever from across the years, plus extensive bonus material including the pilot episode of The White Horse Inn, our famous debate with Dr. Robert Schuller, the Dad Rod Christmas special, which is my personal favorite, spoof commercials, and much, much more. Just send us your tax-deductible gift by December 31st, 2009 for that year-end deadline. For more information, visit our website, whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.
In the 17th century, John Bunyan gave us the character Mr. Valiant for Truth. In the 20th century, God gave us another Mr. Valiant for Truth, J. Gresham Machen, the founder of Westminster Seminary. The spirit of Machen lives on at Westminster Seminary, California, where we've been fulfilling his vision of training men for ministry and preparing them to be expert in the Bible for 30 years. WSCAL.edu, 888-480-8474. Westminster Seminary, California, for Christ, His Gospel, and His Church.
Welcome back to the White Horse Inn. I'm Michael Horton, and I'm talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Marilynne Robinson. When you hear a lot of people go after Calvin, it's this idea of a great God of glory, but also of mercy, who has to save us because we can't lift a finger, really, to save ourselves. Do you think that's part of the offense of Calvin in the modern age of I did it my way, pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps? Our pride?
In a way, it's an old controversy, you know. I mean, it goes clear back to John Chrysostom, this question of whether people have free will. And most theologians say no. As a matter of fact, Calvin is very far from being unique in the, to use Luther's phrase, the belief in bondage of the will. But none of that vocabulary is quite descriptive, because what he says, basically, and he's always writing to people who are his own, in the sense that people who have already found an affinity with him, and he's saying to them, basically, trust God and then act. You know, you're not going to earn your way anywhere. What you have is a matter of grace. Grace is empowering. Grace frees you. You act on the basis of grace, knowing that you are, in a sense, secure.
One of your essays in The Death of Adam is Puritans and Prigs, and it's fascinating how you turn the tables here. You say, the way we speak and think of the Puritans seems to me a serviceable model for important aspects of the phenomenon we call Puritanism. Very simply, it is a great example of our collective eagerness to disparage without knowledge or information about the thing disparaged, when the reward is the pleasure of sharing an attitude one knows is socially approved, end quote. That is so marvelously stated. How do you think the Puritans and the prigs deserve to be reversed in our understanding today?
Well, you know, when you read these sermons, you know, like Jonathan Edwards, for example, he's never saying, we're the good people and the bad people are outside our church. He's always saying, you people here sitting in these pews had better take all this seriously. You know what I mean? When you see, you know, the Puritans would have like a crop failure or a devastating storm. And then they would go into their churches and they would have these days of fasting and humiliation, as they call them. And what they would do is say, what have we done wrong? How do we correct what we have done wrong? You never find them pointing to other people as the source of God's anger, if that's how they interpret it. You never see them saying, we're safe and holy and in a position to look down on other people. You know, that's the opposite of what people say about Puritans, but if you look at the sermons, it's very consistently true. They actually went to church to hear their own faults enumerated and not to have the satisfaction of being congratulated while other people's faults are enumerated. If you look at something like Edwards' sermons on Christian charity, he's telling his congregation, you know, anybody who might possibly need your help, you should help. It doesn't matter if there are other sources of help. You should still help. You know, he uses the the passage from Deuteronomy about open wide thy hand. And, you know, that kind of preaching is always sort of contrary to what people would like to hear. It's always running against the grain. But at the same time, it is making the point, you know, that in every moment God challenges us and asks difficult things of us, and our obligation is always to other people. This is a very consistent theme through Puritan literature. If you look at what they actually prosecuted and so on, you know, or what they actually did to, like, shelter, you know, unwed mothers and so on, they were probably the most liberal community in the world at that time.
R.C. Sproul has said, Jonathan Edwards' day, it was sinners in the hands of an angry God, and in our day, it's God in the hands of angry sinners. Do you think that the sort of human-centeredness, God exists for our happiness, our therapeutic well-being, and so forth, that emphasis makes people like Luther and Calvin and Edwards seem so remote, if not offensive, to our sensibilities today?
That's a hard thing to know. I think that a sort of marketing decision has been made by many churches, many kinds of churches, to present Christianity in forms that they assume are more palatable. And I think that's a terrible condescension to people in general. I mean, I think that religion at its best, and at its, what is acknowledged to be its best, is not pandering. It's actually one place in the world where you might reasonably expect someone to tell you the truth, even if it does run against what your preferences are.
Isn't that kind of an evidence that you've run into reality when it shakes you up a little bit?
I would certainly think so. And I also think that when you think about human, you know, your own life, the very brief privilege of existence on this earth, It's an astonishing thing. It's an amazing thing. And I think that when religion loses sight of how basically miraculous all of this is, you know, they're curtailing people's sense of reality in a way that is depriving them and condescending to them. I think it's a very, very bad tendency and very, very broadly shared among the churches.
One of the themes that I pick up in your novels is grace and forgiveness, and not only what that brings to the person who is forgiven, but the gifts that that brings to others who experience the acts of kindness that come from a forgiven person. Could you explain that? Am I getting that right? Is that a running motif in your novels, especially in the relationship between the two ministers in Gilead? How prominent is that theme, and is that one of the things that you pick up from people like Luther and Calvin and others?
Well, you know, I think the words grace and forgiveness are not exactly synonyms, you know? And I think that forgiveness is something that people struggle with for very clear reasons. For example, you know, with my poor old Reverend Boughton, you know, the fact is that he lost the grandchild under circumstances that were painful to him, that he obviously felt it ought not to have happened, you know. So even while he loves Jack and wishes that he could utterly forgive him, there is something there that has a reality that he can't dismiss. I mean, that there is another person, that is the child and her mother, whom he loves also, you know. I think that grace is another thing in the sense that it really is divine. In the you know, people struggle with forgiveness, but God is highly capable of grace. And I think that when people in a certain way align themselves with grace, they're kind of transcending the difficulties of forgiveness. And that is just, the idea of grace is very beautiful to me, and it's something that I've sort of thought about in my writing, and that I think from time to time I've felt as if I had approached the idea in fictional terms, you know. I don't know if I have, but it certainly has been something that I have thought about.
One person pointed out a comment that she heard from one of your talks: predestination puts self-interest out of the equation, and this seems to me to liberate one to act on motives more consistent with Christ's teaching. And then she went on to say of your statement, a certain self-forgetfulness is the point. Like Calvin, Robinson's cause may be suggested by the word reverence. Her work brims with a deep reverence for life, for our own lives, for others, and finally, for the mystery of a God whom we cannot fully comprehend, but whose unmerited grace towards us is the one fact that abides. Is that fair?
Oh, I think that's more than fair. I think that's lovely. I think it's true also that, predestination as an idea, and you could call it providence if you wanted to look at it from another side, that's something that's all caught up with time. You know, the idea that if time unfolds sequentially, predestination is one thing, you know, because it seems to imply that you can never act in a way that isn't predestined, although, frankly, that's not the way that theologians understand it. But if time is something else and we only experience sequentially, then obviously another kind of thing is being described, something that for which we don't have a vocabulary. But if you take it that you act not in your own interest, if you take it that you can put questions of heaven and hell basically out of account and act as you do out of the desire to know God, which is what Calvin would say, then it's entirely another thing. I think that the idea that you do any charitable act because you think you're getting points for it in a way diminishes everything about the charitable act, including even the degree to which it's a generous act or the degree to which there is pleasure for you in the act of doing it, which I think is, you know, I mean, I think that generosity is rewarded by the feeling that you are in the stream of God's intention, that what you have done is honoring God in the other person, you know?
Before we go, I have to ask you about one more of the essays, Psalm 8, which is full of beautiful prose as well as the ideas underlying them. You're commenting on the psalmist's meditation, "When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars, what is man that thou art mindful of him?" And you point out there that for him there's a place for him and for all human beings and for all creatures in a world that is not here by chance. You write, for instance, "Every seed that falls to the ground is taken into account. One might as well say the earth invades the seed, seizes it as occasion to compose itself in some brief shape, groundwater in a sleeve of tissue, flaunting improbable fragrances and iridescences, as the things of this strange world are so inclined to do. So a thriving place is full of intention, a sufficiency awaiting expectation, teasing hope beyond itself." It's hard to hold back tears at that. I mean, that's just such a marvelous way of teasing out how great this world is and yet how it lures us toward transcendence, something that exceeds even the greatness of what we experience all around us. Whereas what you're critiquing throughout this book, namely modern materialistic reductionism, really gets rid of both not only transcendence but any real sense that this world is worth very much.
That seems to me to be true. I think one of the things that's interesting about that, you know, reductionist worldview is that it doesn't produce anything beautiful. It really doesn't. You know, it doesn't have any literary consequences. No poetry can come from it. It's a kind of self-induced dullness, it seems to me, relative to experience, to what there is to perceive.
Wow. So we shouldn't just think about the contest between faith and materialism in terms of truth, but also goodness and beauty.
Yes, I mean, I certainly beauty. You know, one of the things that I think is very true is that we have to acknowledge the fact that a lot of people who have no religious understanding at all are very good people. And we have to understand the fact that many people who consider themselves religious behave very badly. And this is one of the unfortunate anomalies that haunts the whole history of religious experience. I mean, there's goodness in the sense of, and God saw that it was good, you know, that deep, rich intensity of beauty that there is in the created order. And then there's moral goodness, and I find that very broadly distributed through all kinds of populations.
Before we have to go, why Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Why an interest in his work?
Well, I decided after writing Mother Country, which was a pretty heart-wrenching thing to do, that I wanted to know how people dealt with problems that were crucial in their own time. And for me, it was, you know, the environment. For Bonhoeffer, of course, it was Nazism. And I had the same interest in the abolitionists, that the people who understand what the problem of their moment is and take it on, you know. These people are unusual. And I was very much interested in simply seeing how they did it.
You think Dietrich Bonhoeffer sort of lived in the same world of resources that Edwards and Calvin and Luther and others before them did, in a way that his critics and opposers did not?
I think that Dietrich Bonhoeffer had the extreme good fortune to be a profoundly devout man, and that his orientation toward the world has a sort of honesty and security and generosity that it comes directly from his capacity for devotion.
Interesting. So there were theological roots for his compassion for his neighbors.
Oh, he just seems to me to be entirely theological. he's very impressive in that way.
My producer and I both serve on boards of classical Christian schools. Would you mind giving us an author's perspective on the difference between good and bad fiction?
That's a very difficult thing to do. I think that a good book almost reinvents what it is to be a good book. You know, that it makes its own case, and the bad book fails to make its case. You know, it's a silly way to put it, but I would hate to propose an exclusivist definition of a good book. I think if it's generous and if it's offered in good faith, seriously, then I think the odds are very good that it will be a book of quality. Those things are not at all to be assumed, unfortunately, and so you have a lot of pretty lame books.
Do you think a lot of Christians who are sometimes under the impression that they have to be explicit in their teaching of Christian views in their, especially fiction, end up not really doing great service to the craft of fiction, not realizing that the genre is different from instruction or testimony?
I think that's true. You know, you look at things like Pilgrim's Progress and so on, there are these things that have been written, or for that matter, Paradise Lost, or, you know, that are great statements of faith and that have meant an enormous amount to people over centuries of time. I think that in both cases, both of those texts are exploratory in a sense. They're saying, this is amazing, you know, I'm going to look at this. They're not saying, I'm going to instruct you because I know more than you do, you know, which I think is too often the tenor of any kind of polemical writing, but certainly of Christian apologetics in too many cases.
Well, Marilyn Robinson, thank you for writing books that open us up to a much richer and wider and more interesting world, and for helping us to understand that world more in this interview.
Well, thank you.
For more information about the White Horse Inn, head to our website, whitehorseinn.org, or you can call us at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. The web address once again is whitehorseinn.org.